Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, June 22nd. Did you hear about the rally on Saturday where a million people signed on? No, not the rally Saturday night where a certain somebody boasted that a million people signed on, but only 6,000 came. The one Saturday morning where 1.2 million people actually logged on to MSNBC's Facebook Live event, according to the rally organizers. It was the Poor People's Assembly, organized by the Reverends William Barber and Liz Theo Harris. Here's Reverend Barber on All Things Considered yesterday.
700 people die every day from poverty, a quarter million people a year, according to a study from Columbia University. Thousands of people die for every 500,000 people did not have health care. And so this weekend in Tulsa, Trump was trafficking in division and distortions and possibly death. We were talking about life and liberation. We were saying it doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't have to be.
So that was Reverend Barber after the event. Here's Reverend Barber. I'm going to play one more clip of him from this show. Maybe you heard him the other day in advance of the Poor People's Assembly earlier this month, talking to me on why he thinks the uprising for change that's been taking place broke out now.
But it's also the fact that George Floyd's lynching murder happened in the context of death before COVID. All of these people dying from poverty and the lack of health care. During COVID, 100,000 people died, many of them that didn't have to die because of the inept response of Trump and the McConnell administration. And then we saw these other deaths, the shooting of Avery in Georgia, the hearing about the death of Sister Taylor in her home. Then we see a lynching. And we see it from start to finish. We hear the cries. And I believe when he said, "I can't breathe," it touched something deep in the American psyche and around the world, where too many people are feeling like the government structures that are supposed to protect life, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, life, are actually producing too much death. And so people said, "We're going to come out and we're going to stand against this DM, this death measurement." And yes, what happened to him, like, when Emmett Till died and his mama let it was killed and everybody saw him, it caused Rosa Parks to say it's time to go after the whole system of Jim Crow.
Reverend William Barber on the show about 10 days ago saying how it wasn't just about the death of George Floyd, as big and tragic and horrible and murderous a thing as that was. And it relates to some of the things in the new book, believe it or not, by President Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton, which was also in the news this weekend. For the president, according to Bolton, people's basic human rights are just bargaining chips to be used or discarded in his pursuit for reelection. Here's Bolton on Morning Edition today.
Well, I think that this is an example of how the president's policy is so often incoherent. And how it responds to domestic political pressure. I recount several incidents in the book with respect to the Uyghurs, with respect to the anniversary of the 1989 massacre at Tiananmen Square, and a number of other issues where the president said, well, you know, we have human rights problems too. Now, just recently, he signed legislation designed to clarify his power to exact sanctions on China against the Uyghurs. But even as recently as Sunday afternoon, he was pointing out that doing so could interfere with trade negotiations with China. So it sounds like he's tough on one day, the next day he's not. And I think once the November election is behind us, if he wins, I think it's entirely possible he'll be right back to the trade negotiation.
John Bolton on Morning Edition. With me now on that and more, Washington Post columnist Jonathan Capehart. He's also the host of the podcast Cape Up. Jonathan's latest column is also about the virtual moral march on Washington, as Reverends Barber and Theo Harris called it. Hey, Jonathan, always great to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Great to be with you.
You know, I thought in the clip that we played that Reverend Barber put very well how the police killing of George Floyd intersected with the coronavirus disparities to set off the new movement that's going on. Have you also thought about that intersection?
Yes, and actually, I also interviewed Reverend Barber back in April, I think it was, about the upcoming March, but also about the virus. And he said in that interview that pandemics have a way of widening fissures that already exist in societies. And when we did this interview, it was right at the height of the nation talking about the disparities in the death rates with the coronavirus, with African Americans, people of color, bearing the brunt of the impact of the coronavirus. And so for Reverend Barber, he is already predisposed to seeing the patterns and the intersectionality of what is happening in the country. I have heard the Reverend talk many times, even before the pandemic, about things that are intersecting. And so in the column that I wrote, I made a point of highlighting the maps that he brings along and shows to audiences when talking about these intersections. So he will show you a map of poverty, and then he'll overlap it with a map of the states that haven't expanded Medicaid. And he'll overlap that with a map of states with voter suppression laws. And then he'll overlap that with a map of states that lack LGBTQ non-discrimination laws. And he'll overlap that with women poverty rates, children poverty rates. And what ends up happening is that you see that a lot of the states that seem to be limiting the potential of the people to live, to work, to have access to the ballot box, that they are by and large the same states. And so he shows these maps to try to galvanize people, to get them to move into action, to get them to the ballot box, and just sort of saying to them, if you go vote, you can change the people who represent you, and therefore you will be able to then change the trajectory of these maps that I've just shown you.
And listeners, I recommend highly that you go look at Jonathan Capehart's column from the other day. It's still his most recent column up on the Washington Post site. Well, look at it online. Probably almost none of you have the print edition of the Washington Post anyway, but if you look at it online, you will see all those amazing graphics, those maps that Jonathan was just talking about, and how visually they tell the story of our country right now. So they were going to originally have this big Poor People's Assembly in person in D.C., but obviously not now with the virus, so they made it a virtual event. I did not get to watch any of it myself online, but they did claim 1.2 million viewers. Did you get a chance to see some of it?
And I also, Brian, did not get a chance to see any of the virtual march. But I would suspect, because they've been planning this for a long time, originally it was meant to be live and in person in Washington. They had already begun the planning, and then the pandemic hit, and they turned on a dime to switch it to a virtual gathering, which I think gave them enough time to get the word out on multiple platforms so that they could, as they're saying, through Facebook, to get 1.2 million people.
You know, Reverend Barber and Theo Harris, his co-chair of both the March and the Poor People's Campaign generally, have such a broad view of the change that needs to take place. People who heard our interview with him the week before last heard him lay out five big policy areas that intersect with each other and that he focuses on. And it's so much more than police policy, which, of course, is center stage right now. I guess my question for you on this is, do you think this moment can lead to multifaceted change that really reduces structural racism and structural inequality in the economic and public health and education and other spheres? Because sometimes when all the issues seem to be on the table at once, it's hard to get policymakers to focus on enough things.
That is true, but I think what we are facing here is that all of these things are happening in a presidential election year when you have a sitting president who is doing everything he can, it seems, to pour gasoline on the fissures in society, not trying to heal and bring people together, which is the traditional role of a chief executive, of the person sitting in the Oval Office. And so I think that is also what is fueling the energy behind all of these, all of the protests, all of the concerns. I think people have been awakened to the fact that voting does indeed matter, who elections matter, and that who is sitting in the White House, sitting in the House or the Senate, sitting in your state legislature, your local government, those people matter to what happens to your life at the federal level and at the local level. And so while I agree with you, we've been through this before, where we have seen people being energized and active and hopeful, and then time goes along, and then things don't change as much as people would like them to. I think we are in a different moment now in the country, and I think we will see come Election Day in November whether the president wins a second term, in which case that will be a whole other issue about who we are as a country. But if indeed Vice President Biden does end up being elected president in November, that will present a new set of challenges for that administration. But those are challenges that I think the country would galvanize behind, would rally behind, and certainly push a new president in a more progressive direction. But that's what the country is asking for right now.
So to that point, and my guest is Jonathan Capehart, Washington Post columnist, did you watch that other rally on Saturday night where only 6,000 people showed up in Tulsa for a 19,000-seat arena and they had to cancel the president's speech to the outdoor overflow crowd because there was no outdoor overflow crowd?
So I'm sad to admit I missed the Poor People's Campaign, but I watched all 105 minutes of President Trump's Tulsa rally. And I should have known that something was up in terms of crowd size, because I'd been watching on C-SPAN about maybe 30 minutes before, mm-hmm. and could see that there was lots of empty space on the floor of the arena. In the end, Brian, anyone who watched that rally on television on Saturday night saw or heard the greatest hits from the president. We heard things from in that speech that we'd been hearing since he was a candidate in 2015, nominee in 2016, president in 2017, right through to today. The language was divisive, at times racist, did nothing to broaden his appeal to folks outside of his core group. And as we saw, that core group is shrinking. Now, they might not have shown up because of fears of the coronavirus. The officials in Tulsa were pleading with the White House to not hold the event. They also could have been, and most likely were, victims of a wildly successful prank of teenagers and others using TikTok and K-pop to buy up all the tickets that the president's campaign was saying, we've got a million people who've asked for tickets, and turns out that wasn't the case. Tulsa officials saying that about 6,200 people filed into a stadium that could seat 19,000 people.
Right.
And that just wasn't the case. And if you listen to and watch that entire speech, you can understand why, prank aside, the appeal of the president and his message is waning, especially when you have a coronavirus pandemic, a national global health emergency, and a domestic economic collapse where there's a lot of, and on top of that, social unrest because of the police killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and add to that Ahmaud Arbery by vigilantes. There's a state of unsettling and upset in the country that the president just is willfully ignoring.
The White House, the president's pride being at stake, I guess, doesn't like to admit that it got pranked by teenagers on TikTok and K-pop sites. So the reason they put out was that people didn't come because of the virus, also because of the protests. Or fear of the protests. And I tend to agree that the main reason people didn't come was the virus. I think it shows mostly that the public is listening to the medical experts a lot more than they're listening to the president's reopening rah-rah about what's safe, apparently even in his stronghold of Oklahoma.
Yeah, and a state that he carried by multiple double digits over Hillary Clinton. If you cannot fill a stadium in Tulsa, Oklahoma, then you are in big trouble. And also, I want to point out something else, Brian. That statement that the campaign put out about folks didn't show up because of fear-mongering over the virus, but also protesters blocking people from getting into the arena, they put that out about 20 minutes or 30 minutes before the president went out on stage in the arena, basically trying to make excuses for why there weren't a lot of people at the rally.
You know, to me, the big news of the rally was as much what the president did not say as what he did. So, like, after people signed those liability waivers, he did not address the safety or danger of being crowded in that arena one way or another. And for people who did see it on TV, although the arena, according to Tulsa fire officials, like Jonathan just said, was less than a third full, the people who were there did crowd together. They didn't socially distance, which they actually could have, considering the attendance and the number of seats. But they did all crowd together, and very few were wearing masks. And the president didn't address it one way or the other. And after moving the rally from Friday to Saturday, supposedly out of respect for Juneteenth, he did not have the courtesy to mention Juneteenth at all or what it represents. Holding the rally near the site of the 1921 Tulsa White Riot, which is another reason that people thought that this whole rally was a dog whistle to white racists, he didn't mention it or what it represents. He didn't even try to counter that theory about why he was holding the rally there by saying, this was a terrible thing that happened 99 years ago, but it's not why we're here. He didn't even try. Rather, he chose to center the heritage of the Confederacy as the prime reason he was holding the rally at all. Listen to this clip of the president and how he ends it by saying this is why they're there.
The unhinged left-wing mob is trying to vandalize our history, desecrate our monuments, our beautiful monuments. Tear down our statues and punish, cancel, and persecute anyone who does not conform to their demands for absolute and total control. We're not conforming. That's why we're here, actually.
We're not conforming on Confederate statues and not honoring that part of our heritage. That's why we're here, actually. What did you think about that statement and its place in his reelection campaign?
Not surprising. We have heard that kind of rhetoric, that our heritage, our history rhetoric from him from almost the very beginning of his presidency. We should not be surprised, given what he said after Charlottesville in August of 2017, his saying that there were, quote, very fine people on both sides of the issue, which to my mind, when he did that, he ceded the moral authority of the presidency, and he continues to do it. As in that clip that you played, that is chilling. That is not something that we are accustomed to hearing from presidents of the United States. He doesn't do dog whistles. He does bullhorns. He is shouting loudly and clearly to people in that stadium, to people who may have been watching online and to people who just follow him, that he is standing up for, when he says our culture, our history, he does not mean American history. He is talking about white history. He is bullhorning white supremacy. He is bolstering his standing with white supremacists, white nationalists, and racists in the country, for whom the ongoing demographic change in the country has them fearful and concerned, rather than embracing what that means for a nation like the United States and how our diversity enhances our power at home and abroad. They see it as losing something. And when people are desperate to hang on or desperate to maintain control, they will go to lots of all sorts of ends to try to maintain it. And what they have in President Trump is the ultimate power in trying to do that. And that is through the presidency. And what makes this even more dangerous is, as we have seen, particularly with the coronavirus pandemic, his response to it, such that it is, he only cares about himself. One clip, I don't know if you're going to play it later in the show, but he actually said that he told officials to slow down the testing, because every time there's a new test, the numbers rise, and you don't want that. That it's a double-edged sword. This is from the President of the United States. So if you have a President of the United States who is willing to wallow in white supremacy, bullhorn it from the bully pulpit of the presidency, then we should be very concerned and also not surprised that he would say out loud with his outside voice that he is more than happy to slow down testing so the numbers don't go up, so he isn't embarrassed, instead of going full bore on testing as a means of protecting the American people.
Tina in Manhattan says she watched. Hi, Tina. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I did. It was amazing. I watched it online. I thought at first it would bring me down, but it was very, very uplifting. And I'm sorry I missed him on your show the week before. I'm glad you had him, but something that, you know, again, we're showing, the regular television stations are showing a lot about the Trump rally, and I don't recall seeing much about the Poor People's Campaign. So thank you for amplifying it and reporting on it and bringing it out. But I'm just wondering if it was on any mainstream channels? Does anybody know?
No, it wasn't on any mainstream television channels. MSNBC did put it on their YouTube channel, and that's where a lot of people saw it, I gather. But Tina, was there a moment from it? I realize it went on for a while. Was there a moment from it that you want to shout out to our listening audience?
Well, hearing from, you know, sharp, sharp contrast, what the Poor People's Campaign did was amplify the poor people's voices. So the individual stories are what spoke to me. People were able to explain, you know, how they're one paycheck away from disaster, how an illness caused them to, you know, for their family to live out of their car, or how they bounced back from those horrific episodes. Just their working and living conditions. So it was the individual speaking that really did it for me.
Tina, thank you so much. And Jonathan has a last thought. That is exactly what Reverend Barber said on this show, that he was planning to do. You know, as great an orator as he is, he was not planning for the centerpiece to be a big speech by him. It was for actual poor people from around the country to talk about their lives and the policy changes that are needed with respect to their lives.
Right. And when I interviewed him, he made a point of saying that when people either coming to Washington in person or turning in the rally into a virtual poor people's march, he said to me, what America will see is herself. And by that, he meant you will see the African-American woman who's working a minimum wage job standing next to or be in solidarity with a white coal miner in West Virginia, just showing how all of these people who seemingly are separated by race or class or whatever box you want to put them in are actually in the same fight, trying to make a decent living, pushing up against racism, trying to save the planet by focusing on the environment, looking at all of these interlocking injustices, as he calls them, and how if they were to band together, they could stand a chance of not only pushing back against them, but defeating them, reversing them. And that's why I thought it was so terrific that the last caller not only watched it, but came away energized by it, because that is exactly what Reverend Barber wanted to do. It was not about him. It was about them, the people who logged in, the people who participated in that march, even virtually. That's who that march was about.
Washington Post columnist and host of the podcast Cape Up, Jonathan Capehart. Jonathan, thanks so much for coming on with us this morning. And again, listeners, read Jonathan Capehart's most recent column on the Washington Post site, which not only includes quotes from his interview with Reverend Barber, but the amazing graphics and maps that show so much about America that were adapted from Reverend Barber's own material that Jonathan excerpted from visually in his Washington Post column. Jonathan, thanks.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.